So it wasn't Kofi Annan, the envoy for the United Nations and the Arab League in Damascus, Syria, speaking with the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, that caught my attention. Kofi Annan saying that the massacre that we've been reporting on all week that took place in the village of Hawla, where a number of civilians, according to UN observers, were summarily executed, perhaps 108 of them. Some also died in shelling from government forces. It wasn't the fact that Kofi Annan said tipping point that caught my attention. No, it was the account in the New York Daily News and other news organizations of a little boy describing his entire family slaughtered in front of him, and that the only way he saved himself was to smear the blood of his dead brother on his face and pretend to be dead. That's what caught my attention. The carnage in Syria, has it reached a point where there is any possibility of international intervention? We've seen intervention throughout this decade, but does it work? And what are the tipping points that make such interventions possible? We're joined now to discuss this by David Loin, international development correspondent for our partner, the BBC. David, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, hello, John.
And Philip Gurevich, author and staff writer for The New Yorker. He joins us from right here in New York City. Philip, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to talk to you.
So, Philip, let's just begin with you. How do you evaluate this kind of thing, looking at the situation in Syria and looking back at your long career of covering conflict zones that were ignored by the international community and then suddenly not ignored?
Well, I would say that there's no set definition of what triggers an intervention. I mean, one can't be sort of say that there's a perfect formula for this, much as some of the policymakers would like there to be. It's very much case by case. And it's very much the particulars of a situation. In many cases, what happens is that it's not that there's no intervention, it's that there's sort of a promise that we've got your back, we're there, we're concerned, we want to do something. And then for any number of reasons, sometimes very good reasons, sometimes not good reasons, there's a backing away from the situation. I think what you're seeing in Syria is a situation where we all know, and we've known for many, many months now, that there is terrible violence being exerted by the regime against what essentially are civilians, where there are pockets of sometimes armed resistance, but basically most of the resistance has not been armed, especially at the beginning, and that the violence is extreme, that there are massacres, that there are atrocities being carried out. The UN's put the death toll now somewhere above 10,000 in this period, which makes it by far the bloodiest of any of the Arab uprisings of the last year and a half. And yet there's absolutely no coherent scenario by which the outside world could meaningfully intervene to stop the violence without risking provoking a much, much, much greater calamity. And I think that's the debate. So when Kofi Annan talks about a tipping point, I don't actually know what he thinks he's saying. It's not at all clear that he's talking about a call for intervention, that he's calling for one himself or suggesting there should be one. It sometimes seems like it's him, in the very limited language of his own weak form of diplomacy, trying to say, I've had enough. Mm. And this goes from mere diplomacy to really isolating Syria or so. But it's not really clear what he meant by that. He has no power to call for an intervention in any meaningful way. And he himself, when he was there, perhaps it's his way of saying that his own mission is clearly bankrupt.
Speaking in a kind of plea for humanity code there, Kofi Annan, the analysis from Philip Gurevich, author and staff writer for The New Yorker. Your evaluation, David Loin?
Well, we have grades of intervention. I mean, Philip's right. Kofi Annan can't do anything. We have the weakest possible intervention in Syria at the moment, which is unarmed observers merely going around and recording the horrors that they see. I mean, the next stage up might be, and some French officials have pushed for this, a humanitarian corridor where international forces, police aid as it goes in. That's similar to what we had in Bosnia in the early 1990s. And then it goes up towards further military intervention. And, of course, the most recent case of that, the Western-led military intervention in Libya last year. We're not going to see a Libya in Syria because it's a much more complicated situation. And although we've seen this kind of new world of a doctrine of humanitarian intervention emerging in the 1990s and the first decade of this century, this feels much more like a sort of Cold War dispute where the international community is not going to intervene in Syria because Russia is backing the Syrians right up to the hilt. And the Syrians have significant quantities of weapons and ammunition, and they're still firing those heavy weapons. They need a real logistical chain going all the way back to Moscow to keep that ammunition coming in, and it's still coming. They're also, of course, backed by Iran, and the United States does not want to get stuck into a war where Iran could be on the other side, especially in a presidential election year.
So, David, you know, maybe I'm just a media guy looking for a headline here. I don't know. But are you saying that, say, this little boy in the Daily News who grows up and describes the fact that his family was slaughtered, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago in the situation in Syria, people will go, huh, what? They won't even have remembered that this had even taken place. Is that what you're saying the future is for these folks?
Well, John, the Afshar massacre, most of your listeners won't have heard of it. You probably will. In Kabul in 1992, very similar to this, families slaughtered house by house by armed gangs who, until a couple of years previously, had been backed by the U.S. in the war against the Soviet Union. The Great War in the Congo in the 1990s, a million dead, seven nations intervened in eastern Congo, the Rwandan genocide in 1994, very little intervention, a million died. I mean, there's plenty of examples, even since the Berlin Wall came down, and in this new world of where countries do want to intervene for humanitarian reasons, not for their own reasons of as it were, you know, the reasons why countries used to get involved in war for their own interests. Now countries are beginning to get involved in warfare, and there are some cases where it's worked. Kosovo, Sierra Leone being the best examples in the 1990s, but Syria looks much more complicated than that, and I think it might be one of those places like Congo, like Afghanistan in the early 1990s, the forgotten war, where even though there is the light of the world and there are journalists, brave journalists who've been in there, some of them are friends of mine, who died reporting this, even though these extraordinary stories of victims of these crimes are being reported, I think we're not going to see an international intervention, however much we talk about tipping points.
David Loin, we're going to leave you here at the end of this segment. We'll stay with Philip Gurevich, author and staff writer for The New Yorker. But David, as always, it's great to talk to you about this sort of thing, even as heartrending as it is to conclude that your analysis is probably correct. David Loin, international development correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Thanks, David.
John, it's a pleasure to talk to you. See you, Celeste.